Ah, this is nice, Latimer. Sunshine, sand, a nice sheltered cove, and the sea.
Indeed, ma'am.
What's the catch?
I believe it's lobster, ma'am.
No, I mean, what's going to go wrong? Something always goes wrong.
Oh, I think that's a little harsh, ma'am. There was that one time in Dublin when nothing went wrong.
Yes, that's true. But just to be on the safe side, let's set up the table above the high tide mark, shall we?
Very good, ma'am. In the interests of full disclosure, I should add that there have been rumours of monsters living nearby.
Oh, Latimer, this is Cornwall. There are as many stories about monsters as there are shells on the shore. We'll be fine.
Very good, ma'am.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't been trapped in the agony of judging whether it is Matt Smith or Tom Hiddleston who has the loveliest bottom. Though we all know the answer to that question, really, don't we? I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. It is so good to be back in Cornwall. There's nothing like a bit of sea air to clear the lungs and the mind. The cove is sheltered from the wind, but do shield your cake plates, as getting sand in one's cake is a desperately sad affair. There are plenty of blankets to sit on, so do make yourself at home.
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, but your guest has arrived. A Mr. Christopher Lunt.
Oh, wonderful. Let's see his calling card. Chris Lunt, Chancer.
That's refreshingly honest.
And note, please, Latimer, that he prefers Chris rather than Christopher. Now show him over.
Very good, ma'am.
For those of you who don't know, Chris Lunt is a screenwriter, best known for his three-part thriller drama Prey, which was aired on ITV and starred John Sim.
Mr. Christopher Lunt, ma'am.
Hello, Chris. Do come and sit down. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Glad to get out of that wind.
Yeah, a bit brisky today, isn't it? Would you care for some tea?
Love some, Emma. That'd be delightful. Thank you.
And how do you take your tea?
Can I just have one sugar, please? I've been keeping off the sugar since Christmas, but I think I'll treat myself this afternoon.
Dash of milk or not?
No. Have you got any lemon?
Yes, we do have lemon.
Thank you.
We have to come prepared for all eventualities. And for that very reason, I have some peach Melba roulade. Would you like a slice?
No, you know, I don't like peach.
No!
I like peaches, but anything that's peach-flavoured. I had a bit of a bad turn at my grandmother's once. This would have been 30-odd years ago. And I've never been able to have anything peachy since, apart from genuine peaches.
Oh, no. Well, let me have a look. Well, we do have some chocolate fudge cake. Would that do?
Chocolate fudge cake, I insist on, daily.
Is that why you're cutting down in the sugar in your tea?
yeah, trying to. On the chocolate cakes every day.
Now, I hope you don't mind the chickens over there. You're not allergic to chickens, are you?
No, I wouldn't want to cuddle one, particularly. But no, they're absolutely fine. I mean, they're quite behaving themselves, though they do stir a lot. They're quite cheeky little fellas, aren't they?
They are very cheeky. Now, in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
I brought a bottle of gin, Emma.
A bottle of gin?
Gin, yeah. I've been drinking for quite a long time. As you can probably imagine, I'm 45 years old now, and I've finally discovered the booze that I really like, and it's gin.
Gin?
And I've experimented. Red wine makes me very anxious. Whiskey makes me naughty. Beer's too gassy. But gin, I can drink gin. I turn into a very warm, sociable person, and it doesn't give me a hangover at all.
So, wow.
Gin is very popular with me at the moment. Looking at a bottle right now of gin.
It sounds like you've approached this very scientifically. I really approve of that.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I wouldn't say I'm a very, very big drinker. So when I do have a drink, I like to enjoy it. I don't like to get particularly hammered. And recently, you probably noticed yourself, but there's been a lot of these gin festivals have suddenly you know, come into existence. And last year, me and my partner, me and my wife went out to one of these gin festivals, and I'd never really had it. You know, I'd had the gin and cheap tonic that you get, you know, around Christmas time. My mum is a real advocate of gin and very, very cheap tonic. So I'd not realised what a wonderful drink it is. And since I went to this gin festival, I've kind of become addicted with it. I've actually had a bar built in my garden, and it's a gin bar that I've got in my garden.
A gin bar in your garden?
Top of the garden, there's a gin bar and cinema. And I spend very, very, very many pleasant afternoons up there now with a nice bit of gin and the Star Wars movies or whatever.
Wow, I am so envious. I mean, you know, I have a volcanic lair, but I mean, come on, a bar and a cinema at home, that's nice.
Working up to the volcanic lair.
Yeah, we did have to work up to it, it's true. So it says Chancer on your calling card. What have you done, Chris? Why are you calling yourself a Chancer?
I don't mean that in a particularly bad way, but I think if I was to forensically examine my career so far, I would say that the big moments, the things that have really kind of got me forward, are taking chances that have been offered to me. I mean, an example of that, when I left school, I was an engineer, a lathe turner, and I always, from being a very young boy, had an ambition to work in television, but it wasn't something that was really an option to me, being a, you know, a young lad from Bolton whose dad was an engineer, my mum was a doctor's receptionist. The idea of work, of even going to university, was something that no one in my family had ever done. So I fell from being 16 to 24 years old into a job as an engineer. I ended up being the world's worst lathe turner. I was absolutely abysmal at it. We actually had a reunion last year with all these guys I used to work with at Bell at Worms's, and they were saying, "You never really were a lathe turner, were you, Chris?" I was like, we worked in this factory that made paper machines, and some of the components that were made in this factory were as big as warehouses. They were enormous, and I ended up working on a lathe that was about the same size as a sewing machine because it's all they would trust me on.
Hey, you know, that's weird because my granddad worked in a paper mill, and he's in Bury, which is like down the road from you. So I wonder if there was a connection.
We were at Bell at Wormsley's, and Bell at Wormsley's made paper machines. So we weren't a paper mill, we made paper machines. But in that area, the actual factory I ended up working in was it had originally been three factories, one in Bury, one in Wigan, and the one in Bolton. And we all ended up working in the same place.
Oh, you know, just hearing you say Bury, just Bury. Like, oh. Oh, it's making me feel all nostalgic.
It's, I mean, you know, Bolton, Bury, Wigan. I live in Burnley now, so I've not gone too far. But anyway, my ambition was always to work in television. That's always what I wanted to do. And one day, I remember standing at this little lathe and looking to my right, and there was a guy on a machine maybe 30 years old. Looking to my left, there was a guy on a machine maybe 45, 50 years old. And I just thought, this isn't for me. And I literally walked out and never went back. And I thought, you know, I want to work in TV. How would I go about doing that? Didn't have a clue. Didn't even know what I wanted to be in TV. And I got the Yellow Pages out, and I went to corporate television production, people that did wedding videos and things like that, and safety videos and whatever. And I phoned up ABC Television, and I phoned this guy up, and I said, look, you know, I'm interested in getting into TV. I think I'm quite creative. I'd like to maybe come and pitch some ideas. And I ended up going and working with him as like kind of a sales guy and an oppo and what have you. He was ended up being over in Chester. And while we were there, we ended up pitching to a company that made documentaries for the Discovery Channel, Home and Leisure. So we're talking about 1998. And one day we got a phone call from this guy that was making these documentaries saying, hey, Chris, do you know any cameramen? Because I've just found out that my cameraman's not very well. He's just found out that he can't make a shoot that we've got next week. We need to be in Prague on Friday. And I said, I'm a cameraman. I'd never even used a stills camera in my life. SP camera on my back filming. I ended up doing 8 television series of this series called Two's Country. There was me as the eye and Tim Grundy, Bill Grundy's son, as the presenter, and the two of us went round the world filming these documentaries, and it was basically Laurel and Hardy. He was the know-it-all, I was the idiot, and we used to make these TV series together, and we did really well out of it. And then the producer was a good friend of Gerry Anderson's business partner, and about 1999, when we'd been doing it for about 18 months, this young girl said, Gerry Anderson's looking at doing a new TV series called Eternity, and he's looking for writers. And I said, I'm a writer, having never done anything in my life, and they end up writing an episode of that script, which the series never got made, but I was getting these little tasters of, you know, what I'd like to be. And then I worked for a while with a CGI company called Red Vision in Manchester. And during that period, I was developing ideas. So I'd spend 4 days being a salesman and one day being a developing ideas, just coming up with IPs that we felt we might be able to use and do the CGI for. Quite naive, really, because it doesn't work like that. But that's how I got the first taste of writing and creating TV series. And then in 2010, I got made redundant and decided to give it a go professionally. I had about I had some redundancy money. And I said to my wife, look, I'll give this a go until we've got £500 in the bank. And when we got £500 in the bank, I'll get a job. And when we had £533 in the bank, prayer got greenlit.
Yeah, okay. Chancer is a very, very good label.
What it was, I mean, I'd mingled so much with professional, successful people, and it wasn't necessarily about them working hard. It was about them saying, I'll do that, taking those chances. And it opened my eyes to what it means to be a success. It means about not being scared to fail, being prepared to say, I'll do that. And if you can do that and also work incredibly hard, and the truth is, if you're doing something you love, you're never working incredibly hard, you can't help but succeed. As long as you prefer to fail, and then you step back up and have another go. And that's the only difference. That's the only thing I noticed about these, you know, people who ran companies and had done well. They were prepared to fail, but they were also prepared to just have a go, take that risk. And I've done it ever since. I mean, there's things that are happening now where I'm just doing it more and more. You know, I'll talk about that perhaps in a little bit, but there's other chances I'm taking now, if you know what I mean.
Oh, that's brilliant. So when Prey got greenlit and when they started to make it, how many times during the production did you wake up in the night filled with terror? Or was it not as scary as I imagine?
I think it was greenlit in April and it went out the following April. The news was made public the day before they started filming. So nobody knew about it apart from me and Red Productions from April until about September. But in answer to your question, from the moment I found out it had been greenlit until the moment the last episode had been broadcast over a year later, I felt nauseous that entire period of time.
Oh, you poor thing. Oh.
And I couldn't wait to do it again. And I'm going through the same situation now. I'm working on a job now that's been greenlit, and I feel, and nobody knows about it yet, and I feel physically sick all the time.
Like a stage fright kind of thing.
A stage fright. And you wonder why on earth, why would you want to do that? But once you've done it, you know, you can't wait to do it again. You can't wait to do it again. And I don't know, I'm one of those people as well that, you know, if it's fabulous to hear people have enjoyed something. But also I've got a thick skin, you know, when you inevitably read the reviews that people haven't particularly enjoyed it or what have you, or you go on the Twitter feed, I kind of don't mind them either. And I'll always engage with them and have a bit of a laugh, bit of banter, you know. I'll try better next time, mate, and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, I wish I could be a bit more like that.
I mean, I've always kept my professional life and my personal life very, very separate. I've very few friends in the TV and film industry. Most of my friends are completely on the outside of it, and they wouldn't put up with anything. If they won't put up with me being at all showbiz. So it really is a job I can close my door on, if you know what I mean. I never get too wet up about it. I appreciate that. I'm in a very fortunate position, and I just enjoy it. But I don't think you'll ever get away from that feeling of, oh my God, what have I done, kind of thing.
So when it comes to writing television, I'm really curious about how the medium dictates the way that you structure the story. So do you see it in terms of acts or of ad break lengths or story beats? How do you structure the idea that you have, the raw idea?
What I found is that if you watch a lot of television, there's a kind of dialogue that you pick up on, and you fall into a natural rhythm of a 4 or 5 act structure. You can't get away from it. So I never, ever consider when I'm developing something, whether it's for the BBC or ITV, if it's for Sky, that there's going to be more ad breaks and what have you. Ultimately, regardless of who it's for, if you write an hour of TV, it should break down naturally into what you could consider chapters. So even if it's on the BBC and there's not going to be any ad breaks, you'll find that it peaks at certain moments. It's just a natural rhythm that your writing gets into. The way I work is that I'll pitch an idea in the broadest terms, I'll email it to whoever, the production company or the broadcaster, depending on what my relationship is. It'll just be a paragraph. They'll come back and say, yeah, Chris, we're interested in this, at which point I'll say, well, will you commission a treatment? They'll commission that treatment if they're interested, and I'll write two or three pages. And at that point, I would hope that they'll commission a script. And if they commission a script, the first thing I'll write is a kind of scene-by-scene, which varies in detail dependent upon the idea. It can be anything from 4 or 5 pages, which is just like maybe 2 lines on the major plot beats of the drama. Or if it's something that I feel has got a bit more complexity and needs more explanation about how it's going to work, it can be get up to anything that's 16 or 17 pages, and it's practically everything apart from the dialogue in the script. And once that has been signed off on, and I know that the production company or the broadcaster is happy with that, I'll then write the script. And I find that the harder you work on that beat sheet or outline, then as long as they've signed off on that, there should be no surprises with the script. The script that they get, it should be a strong first draft, because you've all agreed on what is going to be in that script. So I don't have any post-it notes around the office or anything like that, but I certainly spend the majority of the time I spend developing an idea or working on a script is on that document, the beat sheet. It's the most, I mean, to be honest with you, the treatments are the worst thing to write. The beat sheet's a little bit more fun, but it's still a bit of a bind. Once that's signed off, the script can be written in anything from a week to 2 weeks at most. That's the most fun. Unfortunately, it's the bit that doesn't take. It takes the least to do. and then of course, there's 20 drafts of rewriting and redrafting. But there's only been a couple of occasions that I've had to do what I would call a page one rewrite, when I've written a script and it just wasn't working. But the truth is, when that did happen, it's because I realised that what I proposed in the beat sheet, when it was down as a script, it hadn't worked. So I suggested, you know, start again from scratch.
You see, I find this really fascinating, because in the very early stages of my writing life, I wrote 3 novels, learning how to write a novel effectively. And then the really, really difficult thing afterwards was condensing that novel into a single line to pitch to sell. So it was the complete reverse of that process. And about, I think, a year or so into writing what I consider my proper writing, where I started The Split Worlds, I went to this workshop, this day-long workshop, which was part of this transmedia conference, and the day 2 part of it was about developing ideas for television. And I found it absolutely excruciating, because we had to go through the process that you were talking about, where you start with your like high concept, one line pitch, and then you kind of develop it more and more from that point. But I was sitting there being a novelist going, but this is completely the wrong way around. You write the book and then you come up with your one line summary. But now, 8 novels later, I don't know how many novels later, now it's completely changed, because now I have to pitch to my publishers and say, okay, I'm thinking about writing something along these lines, and then the treatment equivalent is the synopsis. And so it's shifted again, so it's very similar to the process you describe, but once the synopsis is written, then I just write the novel. I don't have to do a beat sheet or anything like that. So I find it really interesting, the kind of the top-down process being different depending on the medium.
Yeah.
And, you know, your stage in your career. So with the process that you're talking about, the pitching stage with like the one line thing, is that always the high concept thing? Is that the golden thing you're looking for? Like a thing that will just make somebody go, oh yeah, they can imagine it immediately. Is that the key to?
Yeah. I mean, but I'm quite fortunate as well that my situation, now that I'm a little bit more established, I mean, there was a time when I was pitching ideas and I had to think about it in terms of a sales document. So when, for example, I wrote the initial outline for Prey, and it was sent in initially to the BBC, even though it was ITV that finally did it, it was very much trying to sell that concept and saying, you know, thinking of what might be on the back of the DVD package to make you hire that DVD. I had to think in those terms. Nobody knew who I was, so I was making sure that the idea grabbed them. I'm in a bit more of a fortunate position now, having got these relationships with the broadcasters and the production companies, where I can literally send an email saying, hey, it's Chris, what if we did something that's a bit more like this? So it's less in terms of selling the idea, they know kind of what I'm capable of. So it's more me kind of saying, hey, wouldn't it be a good idea if we had a TV series about this? Do you know what I mean? So it's,
totally.
It's a little bit from my perspective. I don't have to do that difficult thing now of worrying about getting the idea through the door. I'm kind of already through the door and can just try to sell, try to get them enthused about an idea in more of a conversational way. But certainly when I first started, I mean, it's interesting. I often make this point that when Prey was on TV and was quite a success, I was lauded as an overnight success. You know, it was, this is Chris Lunt's first ever drama. And indeed it was. It was the first thing I'd ever been paid to write. And when John Sim, you know, started acting, it was the first time that a professional actor had ever said a line of dialogue that I had written. But there were 180 ideas that I'd worked on that hadn't been made. And the majority of those were ideas that I had pitched over the previous 10 years to producers and production companies. And every one of those ideas, I had had to sell the idea because nobody had a clue who I was over the course of that 10 years. Because what happens is that over the course of you pitching stuff on a very regular basis, they, of course, get to know you. So part of the reason that Prey was greenlit, and what happened with Prey was it went to the BBC, it came right down to the wire on being greenlit, and then they had a drama. They had Line of Duty come on and do very, very well, and they had a TV series called Bad Cop come on and do very, very well. And the BBC just got a little bit worried about commissioning another TV series that you could argue was about corrupt coppers. So the BBC said, look, yeah, we do want to do this, but we want to sit on it for 6 months. And Red Productions, Nicola Schindler, said, well, you can do that, but I'm going to pitch it elsewhere while you're just sitting on it. And ITV very quickly said, we want to do this. But because I had a relationship by that time with ITV, they knew who I was, but they still made me write the second script before they greenlit it. But what had happened over that 10 years of regular pitching ideas was that the production companies and the broadcasters had got to know me as a writer. So the reason it was greenlit was partly that they knew what I was capable of writing, but also that they knew me and my attitude and that I'd do it and make sure that, you know, the scripts were up to standard. And I often get emailed by writers who've done maybe two or three jobs and are frustrated, or had two or three projects knocked back, and they're frustrated that these projects haven't been greenlit. And I always say to them, you know, they're not just spending the money on what you've written, they're spending the money on you as well. They've got to know that you'll see this through. And that, to build that relationship, is going to take anything from, you know, at best 5 years. And that 10 years that I spent writing those 180 projects was as much about them getting to know me as it was about me coming up with a really good idea that they thought could make a good TV series.
Yeah, I've heard so many people now say, yeah, my overnight success took 10 years.
Yeah, it does. You won't. I mean, I don't think you find anyone whose overnight success doesn't take 10 years. But unfortunately, a lot of people that are just kind of emerging or breaking in, they genuinely believe in overnight successes. And
yeah,
don't exist. They do not.
No, and you're right about the stage of where it changes once you're through, because it's exactly the same in publishing, you know, the agony of trying to get published. But now, you know, I can email several editors and say, hey, I've got this idea, and it's exactly the same. But getting through is the painful process. Yeah. Getting into that point where you can do that is...
There's nothing worse than attempting to do that and thinking, oh, it's a closed shop. You know, it isn't. It isn't a closed shop. It just takes a lot of time, and you need to build your relationships, and people need to get to know you. And the truth is that once you're in, you're in. But everyone can get in. You know, what I want to say to kind of emerging writers and what have you, you've just got to stick at it. I mean, it's what I do say, I can't remember where I stole it from, but, you know, the only difference between a successful writer and an unsuccessful writer is the successful writer never gave up. That is the only difference.
Yeah, I agree. So if someone came along to you now and said, look, Chris, write whatever you like, we'll make it, and it's going to have an awesome budget, what would you write?
Well, interestingly, I'm doing it because...
Hey!
Well, I'm doing it. I mean, I'm very, very careful about what I talk about in regards to the stuff I'm working on, because until it's in the Radio Times, it isn't happening. So I see a lot of writers, I get frustrated sometimes with writers on Facebook and Twitter saying, oh, I'm working on such a thing, or oh, I'm doing this, because the truth is, you can be working on a greenlit job, but until it's in the Radio Times, there's no guarantee you'll be working on it all the way through. You know, a million things could happen, from something being greenlit to something being on TV, and a million things can happen to the writer. A lot of things can change. So I'm always very, very careful about the stuff that I say I'm working on, which when I'm doing interviews like this can sometimes be frustrating. But there is a project that I got the novel. I was in the airport, and there's this young guy, this writer called Alan Baker, and I'm a massive H.G. Wells and War of the Worlds fan. One of the things that has been announced I'm working on is The Time Machine at the moment. But anyway, I saw this book, The Martian Ambassador, and I read the back of it, and I just thought, this is a fantastic idea for a book. And in the book, Wells Martians turn up, but they come in peace. And over the course of the next few years, the British Empire and the Martians from the War of the Worlds create an alliance, and there is much daring do and much intergalactic politics and what have you. It's very much like a James Bond film set in Victorian London, where the Martians are, you know, principal characters in it. Just after I've been made redundant, I saw this book in the airport, and I read it on my holidays, and I got back, and I got hold of Alan, and I auctioned the book for £1, and I wrote a spec script and started pitching it about. Obviously, it's very, very high concept. So it ended up going on the back burner. I went off and did The Prey and all that kind of stuff. But obviously, once your cachets raise a little bit, people start saying to you, hey, Chris, you know, have you got anything that you'd really love to do? Have you got anything that you've written and tucked away? And I recently pulled The Martian Ambassador out, give it a redraft, and it's just been picked up by a pretty major production company. And they're attempting to raise the money for it at the moment, and we're hoping that it might be a 10-part TV series. So, it's the kind of stuff I really want to do. I've always been a massive science fiction fan, and one of my problems early on was that the stuff I was pitching was all science fiction. And it was Nicola Shinlander who said to me, you know, Chris, you're an emerging writer, there's no way you're getting science fiction on television. You know, these fabulously established writers can't get science fiction on TV, so you've not got a chance. And she said to me, you've got to write something that's not got ghosts, aliens, or bloody superheroes in it. She said, what's your favourite film? I said, well, you know what, Nicola, one of my favourite films is The Fugitive. And it was in that meeting that we created Prey. I was reading on Twitter people saying, what's this bloody Prey? It's just like The Fugitive. And I'm thinking, yeah, it's not the Da Vinci Code, pal. I mentioned The Fugitive in the first 5 minutes of the pitch.
It's funny you say that, because now there seems to be, you can't move for sci-fi on TV. It seems to be this massive golden age.
It's bounced right back. And again, the big caveat is everything. I've got one thing I'm working on at the moment that's greenlit, but I'm literally embargoed on that. I can't even talk about it. And I wouldn't anyway. We'll come back when it's, like I say, when it's in the Radio Times, and I'll say, that's what I was working on. But I would never talk about anything and say it's happening. So everything I talk about at the moment is, with the exception of that, is stuff that I'm developing, and that I've been very lucky that broadcasters or production companies are paying me to develop. But, you know, like you say, for a long, long time, science fiction just wasn't happening. But now I'm working on The Time Machine with Jed Mercurio for Sky. I'm working on a series for ITV that's about alien abduction. I've got a thing with a production company that's kind of about human genetics and evolution. And I'm working on a thing for E1 that is called The Viper House, which is kind of like X-Files meets Quatermass. So out of the 12 or 13 things I'm working on at the moment, maybe 4 or 5 of them are pretty intense science fiction. And then The Martian Ambassador as well, which is, you know, kind of just moving forward at the moment. And I think out of the 12 or 13 things I'm working on, only one is a police procedural, which Prey was like, you know, everything was police procedural. So it just gets keeping your ear to the ground. Everything comes round. About 18 months ago, it was all ghost stories. The Enfield Haunted did really, really well, and suddenly everyone wanted ghost stories. So yeah, it's a really exciting time at the moment now, at the moment for genre, people interested in genre stuff.
Ah. Now, when I met you, this is a few years ago now, isn't it?
Yeah.
You didn't have a beard. And then your career skyrocketed and you went to Hollywood, and now you do have a beard. So is it actually the beard that has led to your success?
Well, what happened was, when Prey started getting me kind of interviews and in magazines, what have you, this just hides all my chins, basically. that's what it is. 'Cause I had two options. I could go on a diet or grow a beard. and the beard need any real work, so that does.
Oh, and yet again, I am restricted by the boundaries of my sex, and I have to lose weight if I want to do anything about chins. It's so unfair. You men have all the advantages.
Yeah. It puts years on me, but it takes pounds off, so go away.
It suits you. It really suits you. I couldn't believe how different you looked with it.
Yeah, my dad... Exactly. No chin. My dad had a beard for years, from being maybe 25 to 55, I think. So there's always been beards in our family. I quite like it. And my wife's a hairdresser as well, so I'm upstairs in the loft of her and beautician place. So when it's getting a bit scraggly, I just nip downstairs and get a bit of a trim.
So this is a very serious question that, I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you had a Pacific Rim Jaeger, what would you call it?
You know what? Yeah, you know, I've got to be really, really honest with you. Pacific Rim was the only film last year I turned off. I didn't engage with it at all.
I found the lead character really, really, really hard to root for.
Yeah. I mean, I love him. I love the actor. I love him in Sons of Anarchy. I think he's a great actor. But he's just, I mean, if I was to choose something, it would either be a Transformer or like something that fights Godzilla, if I had to choose something.
I think that's what Jaegers were supposed to be.
but I can't get excited about them. I can't get excited about a Jaeger, but a monster along those lines, or a universal monster. I wouldn't mind a universal monster. I'm a big Invisible Man fan. Or I'd like to name maybe a starship. If I could name a starship, it'd be the Nullius Secundus, the second to none. If you ever did like kind of a science fiction movie, my Millennium Falcon would be the Nullius Secundus.
Nice. Something I always like to ask my friends who come to tea, mm-hmm. is if you could have a theme tune for your life, what would it be? Because the very odd reason I have is that the chickens over there that have been just bodding about being very innocuous are actually incredibly talented chickens, and they can sing any tune that I ask them to sing.
Okay.
So what would be the theme tune of your life and why?
Well, it would be the Raiders March from Raiders of the Lost Ark, because that, back in the early 1980s, a lot of people kind of say Star Wars, and Star Wars obviously was a massive impact on most people's my age life. But the Raiders of the Lost Ark was the first film I watched where I fully engaged with the storytelling of it. And it was the first time I thought, you know what, I'd like to make movies. And ever since then, when I hear that Raiders March kicking, the hair goes up on the back of my neck, and it just fills me with full of vigour. You know, if I'm ever feeling a bit down and what have you, I'll put that on, and it just makes me think about travel and the world and all that kind of stuff. So it will be the Raiders March from the Indiana Jones movies. Is a piece of music that really gets my dander up.
Marvellous. Okay then, little chickens, could you sing the Raiders March by John Williams for Chris for us, please? And there they go.
Honestly, I mean, that has genuinely brought a tear to my eye. That's moved me in ways that I didn't expect to be moved, quite frankly.
You know, that film has always had a special place in my heart, and Harrison Ford, but in particular as Indiana Jones, was my first mega crush. Mm-hmm. And the film itself is so beautifully constructed, and the direction, and how in like the fight scene where there's the truck, everything is signaled so beautifully. You know exactly what is going on, who is going where, what's going to happen. It's just beautifully done.
That's it. I mean, I think that's what it is. With the Star Wars movies, it was like watching a toy shop. You'd watch the Star Wars movies, and then you'd look forward to what you'd get for Christmas. It felt like a kind of... You didn't engage with it as a movie. You engaged with it as something you wanted to go out and play with. With Raiders of the Lost Ark, it was the first time I watched a movie and recognised the art of storytelling. And there was a recent edit of it. I can't remember who did it, but they did it in black and white to show the structure of it from a narrative point of view. And it is phenomenally well put together. And I would imagine that if you were to kind of maybe look at some of the things I do and write, the beats of it the stuff I do follows the similar beats of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's like kind of imprinted on me, I think.
It's a good thing to have imprinted. Right, now let me check the teapot. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty. But before I say goodbye, is there anything that you've got that's coming out that's already in the Radio Times?
There isn't. There's a lot of stuff I'm working on. I'm quite the workaholic. One thing that I'm doing at the moment that I'm quite excited about is that with a very good friend of mine, Mike Walker, who wrote Collision and Beowulf, the two of us are setting up a company called Nuke from Orbit, and we've got a first look deal with a pretty major studio. But again, it's everything's with the lawyers at the moment. As soon as you know, it's kind of signed and sealed, I'll be going public with that. But my ambition at the moment, and some of the things that have been lined up for me, I've got is moving into kind of show running a little bit. I think I've got that kind of outgoing personality that can get people sat in a room and get them talking. So the jobs that I've got lined up, the stuff that's been kind of lined up for me at the moment through my agent, involves show running a pretty substantial TV series. I had an interview really recently for another TV series to show run it. So that's kind of where I think my future maybe lies a little bit, in kind of developing TV series and then kind of working with writers to write the episodes. I've got Driven, which I'm quite excited about, which I recently delivered to the BBC for Slim Film and TV, which is a drama set in the world of Formula One in the 1970s. Again, that's just with actors and directors at the moment, hoping that the BBC will kind of get excited by the package that we put together. But it's not greenlit. It's just a bit that I've written. So yeah, it's very, very, very exciting at the moment. Very exciting.
Excellent. Well, I can't actually eke anything more out of this teapot, so I'm afraid it's probably time for you to go. There's a boat waiting for you just over there.
Wow, yes.
To take you back. So all that's left for me is to say thank you so much for taking time to come and have tea with me today. It's been so lovely to catch up with you.
Thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Emma.
Take care now.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
This way, sir.
Hold on, those look like murlocs. But they can't be. This is Cornwall, not World of Warcraft.
Actually, Mum, I've always found it difficult to tell the difference between the two.
Oh, I can't cope with how cute and funny and terrifying they are, all at the same time. And I think they're about to eat Chris.
Don't worry, Mum. I'm sure they're just stories. I've heard that there are as many stories about monsters in Cornwall as there are shells in the sea.
Latimer, if you don't start behaving, I'm going to take some sand home with us and pour it all over the carpets.
Not the carpets, Mum.
Oh, sod the carpets. What about Chris? Actually, what is he doing? How can he be dancing at a time like this?
I think the waggling of his bottom has charmed them.
More than charmed them. They're putting their spears down.
Ah, I understand now, Mum. The Murlocs have adopted Mr. Lunt as their new queen.
Shouldn't that be king, Latimer?
They only have queens, Mum.
Oh, very forward-thinking. Goodness, that Chris has done it again. Such a chancer.
Very droll, Mum.
Time for us to go, I think. Whilst Latimer is clearing away the tea things, I would like to raise my teacup to Becca Reed, Rachel Malosh, Mel, Lisa and Zoe, the newest members of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the esteemed order, go to www.patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy. We've also created a new show called Ask Latimer, which is for patrons only. Each month, Latimer reads out one letter asking for advice that he's received from either a member of the Order of the Sacred Teacup or from a previous guest of the show. He will then dispense wisdom and advice. And I'd also like to announce the winner of the Tea and Jeopardy 2016 Advent Competition, Mr. Mark Powell.
He isn't a relation to a certain Mr. Gareth Lude Powell, is he?
No, and that's not what the L stands for.
Oh no, what's the husband doing here?
Oh, he wants me to mention that The Vagrant and the City has just been released. It's a novella that follows on from The Malice.
Mum, I thought you threw his kazoo into the sun.
I did. Oh, wait. That must be why he borrowed the time machine. Damn.
Damn.
Now find us a new tea there, will you, Latimer? Somewhere relaxing that smells nice.
Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy.
hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.tandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/tandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.